I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, Scott Horton here with Sheldon Richman, and me and him and Jared LaBelle, we run the Libertarian Institute here at libertarianinstitute.org. And, of course, he's a great libertarian intellectual for decades now, has written 10 million great articles on every subject under the sun. And he, for a very long time, and now for the Libertarian Institute, has his Friday article, TGIF, The Goal is Freedom. And a little bit of a double thing there. It's also a restaurant with potato skins. And listen, as you guys know, Sheldon has had this great series lately about Israel and Judaism and Zionism and all of these things, and with lots of different takes and lots of history and lots of really great stuff. I hope you guys will go back and look at it all. And I also want to say real quick, too, that this is going to be a regular Friday thing now, you know, as a feature of the Libertarian Institute, where with rare exceptions, I hope, where we get to go over the TGIF article here in audio format for you guys, too. So welcome to the show. Man, I should have muted my phone before. Welcome back, Sheldon. Good to talk to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back. I'm looking forward to doing this on a regular basis. Always great to talk to you.
Yeah. People have no idea. We talk on the phone all the time. We probably should record all of them. Why wouldn't
Good idea.
We? Yeah. All right. So listen, this one is called Separation, Not Association, Requires Force. And so, in other words, everybody else is getting this wrong and you're setting them straight. So who is it that says otherwise, first of all?
Well, I've noticed when I publish about Israel and Palestine and related issues that I get reaction on Facebook and other places, but mostly Facebook, from people who say, no, people, in effect, people saying, no, the people want to be keep to themselves. There's nothing wrong with that. It's natural. It's sort of the same thing you see with the anti-immigration people, and even including some people who regard themselves as libertarians, which is, you know, most especially uncomfortable for you and me, because you have people who call themselves libertarians criticizing we pro-immigration libertarians on the grounds that, well, maybe you know, there's something to be said for protection of the culture and you know, and so stuff like that, which always gives me the creeps. So, but it also comes up in this issue, because if you believe the state, or I don't know who else would do it, but if you believe the state should be protecting the culture from outsiders, then it seems to me, whatever you may think about Jews, you're probably going to like Israel. And in fact, as I point out in my article, Richard Spencer, the alt-right leader who was caught on, remember, caught at that rally, during, was it after the election? I forget, giving the Hitler salute, saying, hail Trump, everybody remembers that. Mm-hmm. Spencer himself is a fan of Israel. So I don't know what he thinks about, you know, Jews as a religion or as individuals, but he calls himself a white Zionist. The links are in my piece. Mm-hmm. He also says that Israel is the most revolutionary, most important, and perhaps most revolutionary ethno-state, and it's one that, quote, that I turn to for guidance. Mm. And that's perfectly consistent. Actually, I appreciate that he's so honest.
Well, let me add just one anecdote, little story to that for people who hadn't heard it. I think it's so telling, and it's astonishing, but only for a second, because then it's like, yeah, shrug, of course. And he went to Texas A&M and gave a talk there and was confronted by a liberal rabbi who said, no, we are for inclusion and tolerance and this and that and the other thing. And he goes, oh, yeah, you're going to have open immigration to Tel Aviv and the right of return? And the rabbi didn't say a word. He couldn't. He didn't even try to say anything. He just went silent and was just took completely by Richard Spencer, the Nazi.
So this is the reaction I get when I am critical of Israel as an ethno-state. And let me add that it's actually a pseudo-ethno-state, because this is a subject we could maybe go into some other time. But there's really no ethno.
No, we do have time here today. Let's do a whole hour, because we got a few different articles to talk about. So take whatever tangents you want. We can get back to it if you want to.
Okay. I mean, I call it a pseudo-ethno-state because, in effect, there's no ethnic group called Jews. Jews live all over the world and are in many different cultures and many ethnicities, right? A Yemenite Jew is not like an American-born Los Angeles Jew in terms of culture or, you know, national origin or anything. So it's very Judaism is a religious community, as the Reform movement always liked to say. And so it's made up of people from many different cultures and many different ethnic groups. So it's not a single ethnic group, and therefore Israel is not an ethno-Jewish state. Now, Israel itself has a culture, because it's been around now since 48, and it has a language and food and cinema and stuff like that. But it does exclude, to a very large extent, of course, non-Jews. And particularly Arabs, Arab Muslims and Christians do not have the same rights inside Israel, the pre-67 borders, and they have no rights at all in the occupied territories and the open-air prison known as the Gaza Strip. So it's no coincidence that Spencer and probably a lot of alt-right types admire Israel, even if they don't like Jews or Judaism, because they could say, well, that's the kind of state we want too. You know, our group would be a different group from Jewish, right? They would be saying, we want white, who knows what they want, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants to be the privileged ethnic group. So that's why I decided to write this. I wanted to argue that they seem to, and one of the, what the anti-immigrationists and these types like to say is that, you know, they like to call immigration forced integration. You often see this. I've seen this from Hans Hoppe and the people around him who are, you know, don't like immigration and want restrictions on immigration, or they may not call for state restrictions because they say they're against the state, but they envision a day when all property is private, and then they think you're going to have outsiders excluded because it's going to be private property, and the owners of the property aren't going to want the other coming in. That's all nonsense, of course, but that's what they say. So, they say that its association is forced by the state through immigration laws, and they act like sort of segregation is sort of the natural way, because we all really know we want to keep our own kind. Well, I'm just trying to turn that on its head, looking at it historically and sociologically, and just observing people around me. It's restrictionism, it's segregation, it's particularism that needs the force of the state. Mm-hmm. Because the natural way, when people are left alone, is association, greater and greater levels of association. Mises, you know, pointed out or speculated that this got going very early in the history of mankind because people saw that there were potential benefits from trade and the division of labor. So groups that – clans, families, small groups that – were one time distrustful of any strangers, thinking they're just going to come knock us on the heads and take our stuff, so we better go knock on them on the head and take their stuff first. Some bright person said, hey, hang on a second. We might be able to engage in exchange with these people. They have stuff that we want, and we have stuff that they want, so instead of knocking each other on the head, let's exchange. So that's how trust begins to build in the beginning in Mises' story. But we know from fact and fiction that love also breaks down those barriers. And I tell the story, you know, I mentioned Romeo and Juliet, and of course, West Side Story, which was drawn from Romeo and Juliet. And there's countless stories about two members from some kind of warring faction. Maybe it's a family, but maybe it's a bigger group. But two members, a boy and a girl, are secretly in love and want to get married, and they're afraid to tell their families because the families are going to forbid it. I mean, this is an old story. And then I turn to my lengthier discussion is, and I think there's some sort of poetic justice in this, Fiddler on the Roof, which of course is about a Jewish Yiddish village in the Russian Empire in the late 19th century and into the early 20th century, in the Pale of Settlement, where Jews had to live, and about how the protagonist, the dairyman, Tevye the dairyman, begins by talking about how important tradition is. Tradition means, and I even say this in one of the prayers, keeping their children from the stranger's ways. He takes this hardcore position that tradition is what, without their tradition, their life would be as shaky as a fiddler on the roof. This is where the name comes from. So, except the story is about the breaking down of the traditions. Who's breaking them down? The outsiders, the Russians? No, the young people. And this is my point. The young people will always be looking at these taboos, these traditions, these prohibitions on separation with fresh eyes, and they won't stand for it. Some will. Some are more passive in the new generation, but many are going to be on the cutting edge, and they're going to say, no, we're not going to, I'm going to love whoever I want. I don't care if his name is Montague or Capulet or he's a shark or he's a Puerto Rican or he's a New Yorker or he's a or even if he's a Russian Gentile, as the youngest marriable daughter of Tevye says. She falls in love and marries a Gentile in it. And even Tevye, who says absolutely no to this, in the end, nevertheless sends his blessing to that daughter. His love trumped, and I hate that the Donald has kind of messed up that word, trumps the fear and the fear of the other and suspicion and hatred. And that's my point. So the natural way is association. Therefore, it takes the state, or at least some sort of force, to interfere with association and assimilation and all those good things that liberals have talked about from the beginning.
Hey, y'all. Scott here. Here's how to support the show. Patreon.com/Scott Horton Show if you want to donate per interview. And also scotthorton.org/donate. Anyone who donates $20 gets a copy of the audiobook of Fool's Errand. Anyone who donates $50, that'll get you a signed copy of the paperback in the mail there. And anyone who donates $100 gets either a QR code commodity disc or a lifetime subscription, not only for $100, not two, a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks, libertarian audiobooks, listenandthink.com there. So check out all that stuff. And of course, we take all your different digital currencies, especially Zencash and all the different kinds of Bitcoins and whatevers are all there at scotthorton.org/donate. And get the book, Fool's Errand. And give it a good review on Amazon if you read it and you liked it, and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher and that kind of thing if you want. All right, thanks. Well, and this is such an important narrative, I think, for these times too. You know, I had an old friend of mine I talked to on the phone, and he was just really anxious about the future and how things are looking, and everybody hates each other so much and all the racial divisions and all this stuff. And there's so much to it. I mean, I don't want to downplay any of it. And yet at the same time, I'm like, man, have you ever recently been to, say, a little kid's birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese or something? Because what you'll find is that all this racial hatred is on Twitter, but in real life, nobody cares about this stuff at all, dude. Nobody cares. You know, go to Chuck E. Cheese and you have to, have race on your brain to even really stop and take notice. But then if you do, you'll see Mexicans and blacks and Indians and the other kind of Indians and whatever the hell all over the place. And nobody cares, dude. Everybody's just having fun and eating pizza. And so... Right. I think that's, and look, I'm from Austin, Texas, which is a really nice town. There are towns in America where things, there's a lot worse strife and division and whatever. Again, I don't want to downplay that kind of thing. But just in terms of what's the natural order of things, the natural order of things is, hey, how you doing? Not, hey, let's fight.
That's right. Look, you live in pretty cosmopolitan Austin. It's a big university town. I live in Little Rock. Which is not living in some little village in rural Arkansas. I mean, it's the big city, but it's come a very long way. And you see the direction. You see all the things you're talking about: interracial couples, interracial groups of friends, all kinds of people. There's no sense of this, what these people are talking about, like you say. That's obviously what people want. They see the benefits of it, both in material terms, in terms of commerce, but because, you know, let's get back to basic free market economics. You want customers, and your job is to please customers, because that's how you do better for yourself. So you can see how that's already creating or sowing the seeds of trust that goes beyond commerce and material things. It just easily slides into trade of spiritual values, of non-material values, ideas. Ideas get passed around just by trading with people. But also then those other things, because respect then begins, you know, can build into admiration, good friends, romantic love, etc., marriage, etc. So, you know, you see where it goes. That's the natural way. And it may take longer in some places. Of course, governments in a lot of places had to put barriers, Jim Crow laws and things like that, had to create barriers. That's my point. It takes the state to create the barriers. Leave people alone and they overcome this stuff, mm-hmm. With a good help from liberal propagandizing, right? In other words, liberals passing the word and telling people it's a better way to be. There are benefits to this. And so that's what happens when you leave people free.
Well, and which brings us back to libertarians. You know, I've always thought, never mind libertarians for a minute, I've always thought just for regular Americans, if somebody's a right winger or a left winger and their main reason is because they hate and fear the other side more, so they must be on this side, then I'm always very forgiving of that, because I think it's very understandable why anyone would think the left is worse than the right, or vice versa. You know, just depending on a point of view. But like, I would agree with all of your points about each side and whatever. So it makes sense to me. But so, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me why libertarians, too, would be right wing or left wing, depending on which side repels them the most. Certainly, there's a lot about the left, and especially liberals, to be reactionary against these days. But that kind of obscures the fact that at the end of the day, the bottom line is libertarianism is liberalism perfected. Socialism as a horrible deviation from true liberalism, which is individualism, property rights, natural rights. John Locke and et cetera from there, Rothbard. But a lot of times we end up agreeing with right wingers on a lot of things and seeing things, and a lot of libertarians come from the right. And you know, they do, as you say, frame issues like any of these policies that they don't necessarily feel like they agree with. They see it as being forced on them by the left, where in some cases maybe it is, in terms of the law going from, say, enforced Jim Crow to then enforced anti-discrimination without a break in between or that kind of thing. But yeah, no, I mean, like you say, and like you have this great Mises quote that this is, even if you ask, you know, Hoppe or the most kind of right-wing libertarians, that at the end of the day, what's so great about libertarianism is this is how people who don't know each other, don't necessarily need to like each other, can get along nonviolently and even prosper together in peace. That's what's great about it, is this really is the most forward-thinking ideology of all.
But the funny thing is they often get to start to like each other. Neera Badwar, who's a very good philosopher in the Aristotelian and liberal libertarian tradition, has a very good article paper about friendship and commerce. And she's answering the leftist critics, non-libertarian leftist critics, who say that commerce and friendship and things like friendship, even more intense forms, are incompatible because we look at each other as objects, right? It's the objectification of the consumer. And so you don't view, if you're a seller, you don't view the consumer as a human being. He's just a customer. And she shows that that's total nonsense. And she gives like a very common example where, you know, imagine every day you stop at a a little hot dog stand in the park on your, you know, for lunch or on your way somewhere, and you kind of do that every day, and then you hear that the guy behind the counter, his daughter is sick. I mean, it's going to be commonplace for the person to say, "Oh, how's your daughter doing? How I heard that she's sick. How's it going?" And then the next day, you catch up. Any word, any improvement? I mean, so that's when you begin with commerce, it goes from there to the kinds of things you're talking about. So even if it doesn't start with love and friendship, it ends up with friendship, that whole spectrum, ending with, you know, perhaps romantic love and marriage, that whole spectrum. Yeah. And all that follows from the peaceful cooperation that is trade.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right about that.
Well, and look, I mean, in my experience too, and I know there's a hell of a lot of government in Southern California. I don't want to pretend there isn't, but I mean, if anyone has never, you got to fly into L.A. at night and just, I mean, this is some pretty awesome advanced civilization out the window there to see. It's just, it really is incredible to behold. And then you go there, and I think there's a huge exception with the oppression of, you know, where the law basically states blacks better stay south of the 10 or else, which is just, it's crazy. Again, and that's state enforced, and I've seen it firsthand, state enforced by that LAPD, you know, the way it is out there. But everybody else, at least, you know, they have their own little neighborhoods, more or less, that are obviously very fuzzy lines, not real borders of any kind. But there's Koreatown, and there's even Braziltown, and whatever little neighborhoods for all the different Armenians and whatever ethnicities from all around the world, where everybody goes home at night to watch the same TV shows, I guess. But in the daytime, everybody's just an American. Nobody cares where anybody is from other than, oh, that's interesting. But never like in, oh, no, it's an Armenian or whatever. You know what I mean? Nobody cares. Mm. Nobody. And everybody just gets along all day long. I hate to admit that probably part of it is that we all share the same currency. U.S. dollars should be bitcoins or something else, I guess. But anyway, silver coins. But anyway, they all use the same currency. They more or less all speak English. And everybody needs things from each other. And so everybody is engaging in mutually beneficial exchanges with each other all day long. And you drive down the road. And, you know, another thing I really like about L.A. is you don't see, like, the Red Roof Inn everywhere or whatever. There's 10,000 little mom-and-pop motels everywhere. Or hardware stores or pizza joints. It's not like Pizza Hut, Pizza Hut, Pizza Hut. It's you know, Manny's pizza joint on the corner. Everywhere. And it's just great, man. It's as anarchic as hell in spite of all the government, not because of it. Absolutely.
It just shows you the people that sort of want the culture to kind of remain pure is such a idiotic thing. For one thing, there are no pure cultures. Cultures have been mixing, and it doesn't just take recent globalism to bring this about, or the internet. Cultures have been mixing. People have been on the move and intermarrying from time immemorial. So there's no pure culture. But second of all, even if you say, okay, there may not be pure culture, but let's freeze it with the way it is right now, that's going to be a loser. There's no way, even if you thought that was desirable, which it isn't, you couldn't do it anyway. I mean, culture is not the kind of thing that can be controlled. It's a living, breathing, spontaneously changing thing. And with the, of course, with the internet and global communication being so cheap, it's just more so. So these people are, I don't know why they want to run into a brick wall, but that's what they're doing by this crazy objective of somehow preserving the culture. Mm-hmm. From immigrants or foreign goods or whatever the case may be. But it's just ridiculous. I mean, this idea of, you know, go back to this line, keep them from the stranger's ways. You know, Hayek or somebody might say, why do you want to do that? Maybe the stranger has better ways, at least in some respects. Let's find out. And how do we know what's better? Well, we need competition. And I don't mean competition in the strictly business sense, but competition in ideas. This is a John Stuart Mill's point and on liberty. The way we find out what works or what's best or what's true is through ideas clashing with each other in the free marketplace of ideas. So we may find there are better ways. But I don't know what somebody's doing somewhere else, and I won't know if the government is in the way. So it's such a narrow thing. And then there's also Matt Ridley's point about ideas mixing. You know, as Matt likes to put it, ideas have sex. One person has an idea, someone else has an idea. They somehow exchange thoughts on the matter, whether it's in person or indirectly through it just floating around on the internet. The idea kind of gives birth to a new idea, right? That's Ridley's point. The ideas kind of mate, and something new that was unpredictable comes from it. More often than not, it's going to be something good. It may not be a great idea, may not work out, but I'll think of all the great ideas we've had simply by accident. So this shutting off is just a loser on every level. What could anybody possibly say in favor of this sort of shutting things down?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so before we get to back to Israel and the point about their situation and this situation, the Palestinian situation. I think the most common argument I see among more right-leaning libertarians about immigration is, yeah, but all the immigrants are basically socialists. They're all coming from socialist countries, and they are all just going to vote Democrat till America is completely bankrupt to death. And not that the Republicans are fiscal conservatives, Sheldon, right. but you know the line, and that kind of does make sense, right? That, you know, Americans aren't even libertarians, and so why would people to the left of them coming into the country move America in anything but a more statist direction?
It's by no means obvious that if large numbers of immigrants were coming in, that they would all be voting for, you know, big government or welfare state or state controlled industry or business. Immigrants tend to be the go getters, the most dynamic people. They're doing something that people historically have not done, which is move a long way from their home, uproot themselves from the culture that they were born into, the language, and all those things that's attached to, and put themselves into a strange land. Those are going to tend to be entrepreneurial people. How should we respond to that? We should say, okay, this just reinforces our argument against government control of our economic activities. Let's have free trade domestically as well as at the global level. We should use it. The other thing is, you know, Milton Friedman said, and the anti-immigration types, at least among the libertarians, like to quote this, that Milton Friedman said, you know, we can't have open borders until we get rid of the welfare state. And my answer to that has long been, because I heard, you know, heard that he had said that a long time ago. If you save the welfare state from all the stresses and strains, you're never going to get rid of the welfare state. In other words, you want it to be stressed. So let people come in. That'll show the stresses and reinforce our arguments against it. If you save it, if you coddle the welfare state, how are we going to get rid of it?
Yeah, and on the other hand, if I think, you know, the Independent Institute has different studies and other people have done studies where they say immigrants pay way more in taxes than they take compared to regular Americans, that undermines the whole argument than anyway from that side. So,
right. And they're incarcerated at a lower rate. I mean, what can you what? And if you care about Social Security, you ought to want young immigrants coming in.
Yeah. All right. So, there's a great writer at the Libertarian Institute that we've got, Craig Cantoni from Arizona. I just love this guy, man. He's a friend of Charles Goyette, in fact, is where we got him. And so one day, and you know, this is some of this stuff is talked about pretty often in libertarian circles. It's not really my thing. But one day I went to the site and I saw that Craig had written a new blog, and the title was Why Asians Are More Successful, have whatever something. I forgot exactly what the title was, but it made me go, oh no, like, I hope this isn't some right wing take, like, about race and IQ and this kind of stuff that I hate, you know? And I click on it, and it's all just, of course, about bourgeois family values, as he puts it, you know, that, like, how come poor Indians from India, come here to the United States and now own all the motels in the South? And the answer is because they stay married. They don't drink all day like you, dummy, and they work hard, and they decided they wanted to own some motels, so they bought them. Why do they run them? Because you don't. And why don't you? Because you never got around to it. And why not? Because you gave up all your values, and you stopped putting success first and taking care of business and being responsible first. And so now look at you, and now you're mad that the Indians own the motel down the block? Shut the fuck up. And, like, I just love that guy. He's a great writer, really funny writer, too.
Yeah.
And then so that was his whole thing, was like, man, if you really don't like it, quit drinking and read a book, you know?
I never read about an Indian stealing a convenience store from a white person.
Right.
I never read that.
Sometimes they buy them.
Where are they getting these stores? Who's giving them? Is the government handing out convenience stores to people only from India or Pakistan or someplace? Mm. I mean, I didn't read about that. Maybe it's happening, but.
Yeah. All right, man. So now let's talk about Israel. You know, Stanley Cohen, he's not a libertarian, but he's a civil libertarian, a Jewish left-wing civil liberties lawyer from New York City, the very best kind of TV stereotype of that you could think of, with the great beard and everything. He's just and he's just a great writer and a great advocate advocate for the rights of Palestinians, I should say. And the thing is about that guy too is I've talked to him a few times, and he's a very optimistic guy, and I love his attitude about, you know, yeah, but geez, Stanley Cohen, what if we tore down the wall over there? There's this massive separation barrier. People aren't familiar. Put in your Google images, Israel separation barrier, and look at what they're doing to steal property from the people on the West Bank, from the Palestinian people there. And of course, there's, you know, as we've talked about in other interviews, and as is going on, the siege in the Gaza Strip and all of this. And they're all refugees there. 80% of them are refugees there in the first place. And so, hey, Stanley Cohen, but what if I Dream a Genie just tore down the wall and then made it one state and what have you? And he says, it'd be fine. There's no reason there'd have to be a civil war over Israel giving up its Jewish super-duper majority rule over the Palestinians there. That basically all that has to happen is you protect everybody's rights, and then you let them do business with each other, and then you let them marry each other and get along, and they'll forge relationships, and it'll be just fine.
Well, the problem is that the Israeli public, the Jewish part of the Israeli public, has had anti-Arab racism drilled into them in schools and the media, and it's reinforced by the government. And as far as I understand, the Israeli public, the Israeli Jewish public, does not like Arabs and would like them out. I mean, here's a difference I point out in this article, or maybe it's the this article that. We refer to Israel as an apartheid state, but there's a big difference between Israel and what South Africa was. And this is a point made by Shlomo Sand, who I discuss in this piece too. No, I guess it was in last week's piece. But the point is, in South Africa, the whites didn't want to kick the blacks out. They needed the blacks. They needed the blacks to do the crap jobs, you know, to clean the toilets. So while they had all that legal separation and the blacks didn't have rights, they didn't want to kick them out. In Israel, from the beginning, they wanted the Palestinians out. They wanted the Arabs out. They didn't need them to do clean the bathrooms and stuff like that. They already had the Arab Jews. Those are the Jews who came from Arab lands, Iraq and other places, and Africa. They had later some black Africans from Ethiopia. They had people to do the dirty jobs. They didn't need the Arabs. They didn't want the Arabs. They were redeeming the land. Don't forget, they were redeeming the land for the Jewish people. That was the language they used. And not just the Jewish people living there, but the Jewish people all over the world. It's an odd state because it's not, you know, in theory, a republic is supposed to belong. Now, libertarians can criticize this, of course, but in theory, now, a republic belongs to the citizens. That's the idea. It comes from the res public, matters, public matters. It's about the public. It's about the citizens who live there. Israel's not the, quote, property, even in theory, of the citizens who live in Israel. I'm talking now like pre-67 borders, not talking about the territories. It belongs to Jews both Jews in the state of Israel and Jews everywhere else. And then that, of course, opens the question of who's a Jew, which has been a fight in Israel from the very beginning. Who counts as a Jew? A Jew should be is supposed to go to be able to go to Israel, and that they want you to go to Israel, and you can become a citizen, you know, in a day or two, if you're Jewish. But the question is then, you know, who's Jewish? And so that's a whole other subject. But that's the point. It's not the state of the citizens of the state. On your identity card under citizenship, it doesn't say Israeli, or on a nationality, it doesn't say Israeli. It says Arab or Jew or other. If you're not an Arab and not a Jew, you're a Russian, not a Russian Christian. It'll say other. So it's a very weird situation. It stands out. And what makes it important to Americans, I think, is that, number one, it claims, you know, everybody likes to say it's the only democracy in the Middle East. And, of course, it gets all that money from the American taxpayer. And American administrations, Republican and Democrats, stand by Israel no matter what, no matter what atrocities are committed. That's one reason it matters. It would matter just as a matter of justice, but it could have matters extra specially because Americans have been, hitched to Israel against their will and on the basis of lies and propaganda for many, many years, since 1948.
Well, I mean, but Israelis are also propagandized all day long with the idea that all the Palestinians want to do is just cut all their throats, when in fact the Palestinians are just saying they want to come home. They're not saying they were going to push all the Jews into the sea or any of that crap. That's all made up crap. In fact, that phrase was coined by a Mossad agent in Egypt back when I learned one time. I'll have to find it. But anyway, so that's the thing of it, right, is that, okay, Gideon Levy in his recent speech at the Grant Smith's Israel Lobby Conference, he said, as you said before, the Israeli public, therefore this policy of apartheid, absolutely, and taking it all one day and what have you, and there's no turning back for them. But he also said, if the American people change their minds about this, the Israeli government will change its policy overnight, because that's it. The USA is the only thing, this is an important point, Americans, the USA is the only thing that's allowing them to continue to get away with what they're doing with the occupations on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the rest of this. And so he said, if the Americans just said, listen, we're done with this and we really mean it this time, then the policy would really change. And therefore, sort of like in when the Supreme Court struck down Jim Crow, like, look, you guys might be terrified of what's going to happen, but we're going to see, because we're not letting you keep this system anymore. That if that happened, then back to your point and back to Stanley Cohen's point, do you think that the Israeli Jews would be surprised to find out that the Palestinians are all right and that they can all get along in one state with equal rights anyway?
I wish I could share that optimism. That does not strike me as the likely prospect. If the U.S. were to end all military aid and other aid to Israel, I don't buy that. I mean, I just don't see it. It doesn't strike me as...
Yeah, but what about your article about association and separation? That if we stop forcing the separation, don't you think them, you know, cooperation would be natural, like we were talking about for the first half hour here?
If you had thrown in the words someday, then I would agree with you. But someday, it seems to me, given all that's happened, is way into the future. There is a deep, visceral hatred against Arabs and non-Jews. And I don't believe that's going to go away if the U.S. Pulls all the aid and they're going to say, well, I guess we're on our own now. I guess we should start getting along. Things don't change that fast. Given all that this buildup, and so I just can't share that optimism. It's going to take more time than that. Shlomo Sand likes to say, he might prefer a single secular state, but he doesn't think the Israelis are ever going to agree to a system that a single state in which the Jews are a minority. Because the total number of Palestinian Arabs and Muslims outnumber, if you're counting the West Bank and the Gaza, outnumber them. They won't go for that. But you might be able to get them to go for a military withdrawal from the occupied territories, leaving two states. Now, when he says two states, he doesn't mean he doesn't say a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. He says a Palestinian state and an Israeli state. In other words, a secular state that doesn't tilt the playing field in the direction of Jews. Any citizen there, and anybody could become a citizen, as, in his view, through normal processes, would have full rights. So two secular states. You know, I don't know what the best fix is for all this. There's so much going on, and there's such deep-seated animosity on the Israeli side because they're you know, even secular Jews still, whatever that means, that's a whole other subject, but still have this sort of religious premise that, no, this is ours. And you say, well, you know, if you don't believe in God, how, what do you mean it's ours? Well, the Bible's a history book, so it's ours. I mean, it's nonsense, but there's something very deep there. And I don't think pulling American aid out is going to suddenly make them say, oh, let's all get along now. That changed everything. I just don't see that. I'd like to believe that, but I don't see it. I mean, I want to end the aid, but I don't see that happening. I'll have to read more of Levy and see his case.
Yeah, well, you know, Norman Finkelstein and Uri Avnery and others, too, who are, you know, very pro-freedom for the Palestinians, they are also very firmly two-state people because they say the alternative is basically the status quo. Forget about it, because the one-state thing, you know, they'll have another war first, basically. They'll never accept it, and they're the ones, the Israeli side, have all the power. And yet, I don't know, man. I gotta say, when I interviewed Max Blumenthal and Dan, well, it's not the interview, Dan Cohen and Max Blumenthal, they made this movie, Killing Gaza. I don't know if you got a chance to look at it.
I have not seen it yet.
So the thing is, you know, we use the phrase apartheid and Jim Crow and this and that all the time. I do. That's my frame of reference for all this. That's the reality on the ground there, the total totalitarian foreign military occupation and subjugation of these people. It's just criminal. But then you, well, I hate it when people talk in second person. For some reason on this, I switched to second person. Well, I'm looking at that video, and I'm watching these people. It's just interviews of the average Joe Palestinian saying, yeah, so this is what happened to me today, pal, and talking about the 2014 war and this kind of thing. And it really hit home all over again what I already know, but in just a much more real way. That, no, this really is. It's just like the very worst of Alabama and Mississippi in the days of the 1930s Jim Crow or whatever. You know, lynchings every week or whatever. This just absolute outlaw, merciless regime against these people. And it's going on right now every day. And nobody's doing a goddamn thing about it. Like, this is permanent. It would be like if we had Jim Crow in the South right now and it was still the law and also no one was changing it. And this is just the thing. This is how we're doing it. That's the reality of how horrible the situation is for the occupation of these people. And so then that makes me think that, no, man, this has got to change. It's going to change. This is absolutely untenable that it continue to go on like this. Something's going to happen. BDS or something else is going to make this different. This siege of the Gaza Strip, I mean, this cannot maintain. So I don't know, man.
And let's not neglect the Palestinians, the Arabs, Muslims, and the Christians inside,
right,
what they call the green line, because they you know, the defenders of Israel will say, "Oh, what's your complaint? They have the right to vote. They have parties. They have representation in the Knesset." Well, it's true, but it's extremely limited, and we saw an illustration of this just as there was it this week, where a bill was introduced in the Knesset to declare equality of all citizens. Now, this is nothing about the occupied territories, right? Equality of all Israeli citizens.
Right.
And it couldn't even come to the floor. It got it, because there's what they call the basic law in Israel that you can't change by the democratic vote in the Knesset. It's beyond the reach of those you know, few Arabs and Arab parties in the society. So it's marginally better for Arabs inside the Green Line than it is for occupied territories. You know, until the 60s, until 66, that this was before there were occupied territories, except they were occupied by Jordan and Egypt, but they weren't Israeli held yet. But the Arabs inside Israel were under military rule until 1966. From 48 to 66, they were ruled by the military inside of Israel. It was only, with time that they needed the resources. In fact, 66, no coincidence, that was a year before the 67 war. Mm-hmm. And they already had their eye on those territories, and they needed the military resources for that. So they decided to then institute civilian rule over the Arabs inside, so they could then use that those military resources in the territories they intended to acquire, and which eventually they did acquire in the 67 war. Those were territories they wanted in 48. But they, because of contingencies realism, and they couldn't get everything at once, they settled for less. But it was always on the agenda. Don't forget, when Israel declared independence in 48, they did not declare their borders.
So I'm so glad you mentioned that, because someone was asking me recently, what does that even mean?
Because it was open-ended. They didn't know how much they were going to grab in 48, and if they whatever they didn't grab in 48, they knew they'd get later on. Don't forget, they attacked Egypt. Israel attacked Egypt along with France and England in 1956, hoping to unseat Nasser. And they took the Sinai. It was only, U.S. leaned on them. Eisenhower wasn't happy about this, and he leaned on them, and they had to back off, and it was a big embarrassment. But then they wonder why Nasser was suspicious of Israel. As they go to 67, he's made out to be the warmonger. They tried to knock him out in 56. I mean, nobody ever looks, people always are walking into the middle of a movie and they think they understand it. They look at the 67 war. What do? They start on what, June 1st, May 30th, and say, oh, let's look at the causes. I'll start on May 30th, 1967. You got to go back to 48, if actually earlier than that, but 48's okay. That's not a bad starting point. Take a look at what happened there. Take a look at Israeli attacks on Egypt in the 50s and Syria in 65 and Jordan in 66. I mean, look at all those things that are going on if you want to understand 67. Don't tell me what happened on June 1st, 67, and say you understand the causes of that at war. It's ridiculous.
Hey, let me tell you about the sponsors of this show. First of all, Mike Swanson. He is the author of the great book, The War State, about the permanence of America's World War II military empire through the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy administrations, the rise of the new right military-industrial complex after World War II, The War State by Mike Swanson, and also get his great investment advice to protect your financial future there at WallStreetWindow.com. He has a great understanding of what the hell is going on in these financial markets. WallStreetWindow.com. Unless I know he'll tell you, you got to have at least some of your savings. You must know. Some of your savings, however much it is, you got to have metals. And so what you do is you go to Roberts and Roberts Brokerage Inc. Gold, silver, platinum, palladium. They have a very small brokerage fee in order to process for you and get you the very best deal. And if you buy with Bitcoin, there's no premium at all for your purchases of gold, silver, platinum, palladium. So check those guys out. Roberts and Roberts Brokerage Inc. at rrbi.co. You ever play baseball? rrbi.co. And as I mentioned, Zencash is a great new digital currency. It's also an encrypted method of internet messaging and document transfer and all kinds of things for your business, for your secret conspiracies. Zencash.com. Check that out at zensystem.io. You can read all about how it works, every last detail, of course, at zensystem.io. And then there's this book about how to run your technology business like a libertarian. It's called No Dev, No Ops, No IT. And each of those is one word, three words, get it? Yeah. No Dev, No Ops, No IT. It's by Hussein Badakhshani, and it's about how to run your business right in a libertarian way. LibertyStickers.com. I guess Rick didn't like the great new website, so we'll have to wait. Someday we'll get a new website. There's still a lot of good stickers on there, but we've got a lot of good art that's not up there yet. I don't know, man. LibertyStickers.com. That's the new slogan. I don't know. And Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. If you like learning things, I'll get a commission if you sign up by way of the link on my website. And listen, if you want a new, and the reason my website is down is my own broken servers. But if you want a new good-looking website like the one I do have when it's up and running at scotthorton.org, then check out expanddesigns.com/Scott. Expanddesigns.com/Scott, and you will save $500 on your new website. All right, now, somewhere in there, you briefly mentioned Iraqi Jews. And you mentioned it in the context of them being treated as kind of second class citizens, I think, inside Israel anyway. You have this recent article, a very important one, The Abused Jews of Iraq. I think the last I read, there were 8 Jews left in Baghdad, but even that may be outdated now.
Well, I wasn't talking about those, and of course, I wasn't saying that the Iraqis were abusing the Jews, as you know. It was a come-on. I was trying to hook people on the article by through confirmation bias, which they then turned against a lot of the readers. The point is that there was an old Iraq. Look, Iraq is Babylonia, right? So when the Hebrews, the Israelites, had to leave in, whatever year that was, B.C., or before the Common Era, B.C.E., you have the Babylonian exile, where Judaism actually flourished, and the prophets said, "Make your homes here, be at peace with everybody, get along." In other words, don't think about going back anywhere. This is our new home. So there was an old Jewish community going back to that time. When we get into modern times, in 48. There's still a Jewish community, Arab. These are Arab Jews, and they're doing very well. I mean, as we know from it's been told countless times that the Arabs and the Jews in the Middle East and in Spain live together quite well. Was it perfect? No, but nothing's perfect. But there wasn't pogroms, nothing like you saw in Europe, pogroms and worse. They got along. As everybody knows, Islam sees the Jews and Christians as people of the book. They see a continuity. They think Muhammad was the last prophet, but they see him in a line, you know, beginning with Moses or whoever is regarded as the first prophet. The God is supposed to be one God in their view. It's not the Muslims don't have like a separate God who's better than their God. It's the same God. So this gives some context here. They didn't persecute the Jews the way Christians did for so many years. So the Arabs, the Arab Jewish community is a prosperous community. They're high ranking in commerce and different lines of work. You can find stuff. You can find interviews with people on YouTube about this. Once Israel is independence comes in 48, in 1950, the Jewish community still. I mean, the Zionists are trying to get the Iraqis and all other Jews to move to Israel. So we got to remember that. I keep jumping around, but everything's connected to everything else. Israel, after the World War II, because of the horrors of Nazism, was portrayed to Westerners, especially, as a humanitarian refugee project, right? A rescue project. Let's get these poor, displaced Jews from Germany and Europe to a new home, some safe place. But that's not what Zionism was, and it never really changed. That was public relations. It was always about the ingathering of all Jews to Palestine, to this homeland, because as Herzl and others like to say, they agreed with the anti-Semites. The Jew is going to be alien anywhere but his own homeland. Now, liberal Jews, reformed Jews, were outraged by this. You know, when they were appealed to in America, they'd say, "We have a homeland. It's called the United States of America. We love the Declaration of Independence. We love all this stuff. We're not Jewish. We're not American Jews. We're Jewish Americans." That's what the reform was founded in opposition to Zionism. So they tried to also get Iraqi Jews, Yemenite Jews, Egyptian Jews to move to Israel. They didn't want to move to Israel. They were in their homes for a very long time, and they were happy in their society. Suddenly, in 1950, bombs start going off in Baghdad, near Jews, near outside of our synagogue and a community center outside a U.S. Information center where Iraqi Jews hung out and read. They had access, I guess, to books and magazines. And there's a suspicion going around that there's some Arab organization, you know, that hates Jews and is trying to drive the Jews out. And a whole bunch of them left because of that. They panicked. And there was some, and this is not, this can't be defended. There was rising Arab nationalism, much of it in response to the formation of Israel. Some people took it out on the local Iraqi Jews, which was despicable. They should have never done that. They should have made the distinction between Zionists who were European imperialists coming in and Jews who had lived there for generations and were perfectly fine. I mean, so I don't condone that whatsoever. But Jews in great numbers from Iraq ended up going to Israel. And today you'll hear, if you condemn Israel's ethnic cleansing in 48, you'll hear defenders of Israel say, I hear it almost all the time, what about what the Iraqis did? How about the Jews that got driven out of their Arab homes? Well, in Iraq, it turns out that it wasn't Muslim or Arab Christian. They weren't non-Jewish Arabs trying to drive the Jews out. That was an homegrown Zionist organization called the Movement. This is all on the record. Participants have confessed. There were trials where people explained the whole thing. This was a combination of Israeli Zionist agents and Iraqi Jewish agents working for Zionism to try to scare the Iraqi Jews out of Iraq to get them to Israel. They needed the bodies. They needed the work. They needed the workers. They needed the people to do what, you know, the clean the toilets and stuff, because the Arabic Jews got treated very badly. They were like the blacks. The Palestinians were below that. The Arab Palestinians were even below that. They were third class or worse. The second class citizens were the Arab Jews, the Jews that came from Arab lands. They're sometimes called Sephardim. But Sephardim means from Spain, and these people were not from Spain, so it's really not a good term for them. You can find a great interview on YouTube with Naeem Gilati. He died in the late 90s. This is from the 90s. He was an Iraqi Jew who worked with the Zionists to try to scare Iraqi Jews into leaving. He then moves to Israel, and within a short period of time becomes a journalist. He becomes an anti-Zionist and an advocate. He ran an organization called the World Organization of Jews from Arab Countries, or Islamic countries. He calls them Islamic Jews. In other words, Jews who hailed from Islamic countries. So it's a terrible story that the people don't know about. And yet it's not just, you know, fringe groups saying, oh, I think this is what happened. There were trials. People got convicted. There were trials that were regarded as legitimate trials. There were weapons being stockpiled in synagogues that were being smuggled in to create trouble. Similar thing happened in Egypt. You had Israeli agents going into Egypt. You have the famous Levant affair, where they were attacking American facilities to try to drive a wedge between the Egyptian government and this is early 50s and the Americans, and also scare any Jews there out and get them to Israel. The idea was to get all the Jews to Israel.
Man, and I mean, you think about the absurdity. I keep going back to this. I know that. You're from a Jewish family and you don't identify as Jewish because, as you like to make the distinction, that it's a religious belief. It's not something that you can inherit from somebody really anyway, other than in terms of what you're taught as a child, kind of a thing. I'm even further removed from Judaism than that. I have Jewish, ancestors in my family and that kind of thing. But then by technicality, even though if I have a tribe at all, it's punk ass Northwest Austin skateboarders, right? Or something like that. I have the birthright to colonize some Palestinians' olive tree orchard and make it my own on the West Bank by some birthright. by some magic supernatural right to his property, and he does not have a right to resist me. That's the deal. Even though I have virtually no connection to Israel whatsoever. But under their technicality, hey, they need warm bodies to help colonize this land and take it from the people who actually own it.
And see, the problem was, you know, as the 20th century wore on, it was a more and more secular age. So you have a lot of people who identify as Jews who don't believe in God and don't practice the religion. And yet they may, you know, celebrate holidays and they would call themselves secular Jews. So there's a problem because, you know, what does it mean to be a secular Jew? Shlomo Sand likes to say, how does somebody become a secular Jew? If you need to have a Jewish mother, well, how do you get a Jewish mother? I actually gave him an answer to that. You get your mother to convert. That way you have a Jewish mother. I don't know if that counts, but it's at least it's one potential path out of it. It's not a class you can. It's the ultimate in restricted clubs, right? Secular Jew. There's no way to convert to secular Jew. Someone else suggested, well, you convert to Judaism and then you denounce, you know, renounce the religion. So then you're a secular Jew. I don't think any of those things actually work. So what does it mean? So what's the point is there's nothing to hang your hat on if you because there's no secular Jewish culture. Like I said, Jews are of many cultures. They have religious culture. Because they all go to the synagogue, they all put on, you know, cover their heads. So there's a religious culture, but there's no worldwide secular Jewish culture because Jews in different lands eat different food, respond to different humor, have different movies, you know, all that stuff, different cuisine. So there's no secular Jewish culture. So what's a secular Jew mean? Well, what's happening, and this has been happening in Israel now, I guess, for a few decades, they're being driven to look for the Jewish DNA, Jewish blood. Now, this is really funny. In the 1930s, if you said there was a Jewish race, you'd be denounced as an anti-Semite. Today, if you deny there's such a thing as a Jewish race, you are condemned as an anti-Semite. Look how things have turned around. Hitler was looking, insisted there was a Jewish race, and they were measuring people's noses and heads. Remember all that stuff? Mm-hmm. They would have said there's Jewish blood. In fact, that was the test. If you have one drop of Jewish blood, you're Jew. Today, it's the Israelis and the Zionists who are arguing, no, in effect, they're saying Hitler was right. There is Jewish blood. But of course, there isn't. The studies are nonsense. There's plenty of studies going the other way. Jews in the early centuries of the Common Era converted large kingdoms of people in where Iraq is today, in Yemen, in the Maghreb, in Libya. The Berbers, many of the Berbers were converted. They live
Ethiopia
in North Africa
too, right?
Ethiopia. But and guess who was a Berber? Gaddafi was a Berber. Gaddafi might have had a Jewish grandmother for all I know. But these were converts. And then they moved. I mean, the big prize was the kingdom of Khazaria, which is north of the Caucasus Mountains between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. So it's now Russia. But it's north of the Caucasus, not below where Georgia and Armenia and Azerbaijan are. That was a big kingdom that was caught between the Muslims to the east and the Christians to the right. So the king said, okay, I'll be a Jew. He figured he'd be neutral. He wouldn't antagonize one or the other. Who knew? He would antagonize both by doing that, but he didn't know that. So when he converts, the whole kingdom converts, right? He's the king. It's good to be the king. Eventually, they get defeated. That kingdom lasts for 300 or 400 years. This is no fly-by-night kingdom. This is a Jewish kingdom. There are many observers of the time saying that these people were Jews. Then I think the Mongols, somebody comes in from the east, and it destroys the kingdom after lots of fights, and they disperse to the west, into Western Europe. So there's a very likely story that a good number of, maybe the overwhelming majority, maybe most of the Ashkenazi Jews, which are the European Jews, are Khazars, which means, and this has no political relevance, by the way, which means they can't trace their lineage back to the Holy Land, because their lineage goes back to Khazaria, the kingdom of the Khazars, or possibly Western Turkey. There was a converted group in Western Turkey, I think, that helped convert the Khazars. The point is, all those lines have been broken. But like I say, it's politically irrelevant. I mean, this is kind of interesting. But
well, and I mean, on that point, I mean, they would say, and I've heard this before, I mean, you have your opinion about the studies, but I've read that, no, there's a study that showed that there must have been at least, I read one a few years ago, I think, I'm almost certain it said there must have been at least two Jewish women who were on the matriarchal line on the chromosomes and whatever that trace back all the way to ancient Hebrew Stan and on the eastern shore there. But I mean, the point being at that, like, yes, so what? Like, what's so magical about that anyway, right? When the king converted, he took a Jewish wife and that made a difference, then, but what difference did it make?
Well, let me divide this in two parts. First, on the actual merits of this genetic claim, there's serious work being done by Aaron L. Hake, who's at the Johns Hopkins Medical School. He's got this DNA project, and they're doing very serious work, and they're comparing the DNA of Ashkenazi Jews to the DNA taken from bones of ancient people buried in the Holy Land. This has not been done before. So that's one thing, and it strengthens not just the Khazar thesis, because Arthur Koestler, of course, wrote a book about the Khazars in the 70s called The 13th Tribe. But what he didn't know, because we know so much more, both in terms of history and genetics and archaeology and anthropology, was there was this group of converts in Turkey, Western Turkey, who went to Khazaria. So I may not be able to trace my line back to the Khazars. They may be the Turks. Yiddish, there's evidence now that Yiddish didn't originate in Germany, which is what people think, but rather in an area closer to Turkey, Western Turkey, partly in Khazar, with a lot of Slavic influence. Okay, so there's that one point. So this is not a crazy thesis. In fact, back in the 70s or 80s, I went to a Jewish day school that some relative of mine must have been going to. And I went into the library because I was first hearing about this thesis. I went into the library there and looked at the five or six standard histories of the Jewish people in that library. Gratz, I forget the names of the authors. Every one of them acknowledged the Khazar thesis, that the Khazars was a great kingdom that converted. And by the way, it wasn't a nice kingdom. They forced conversion on other people. And you know what I mean when I say forced conversion? It means some surgical procedure we may not want to talk about. It's a serious thing. So I'm not saying these were nice folks, but they did convert. And Jewish historians never hesitated to acknowledge this and talk about it. It's only later when it became politically inconvenient. And then it got denounced as an anti-Semitic, lie. But it was all in the major histories. Now, the political subject, you're right. Let's say the Khazar thing and the convert thing is total nonsense, and anybody who has a Jewish mother today can trace his DNA back to the Holy Land. There's no property rights. No property rights come out of that, right? I can't go to Israel tomorrow and say, look at some Palestinian who's living in a house and say, hey, 2,000 years ago, some relative of mine lived there, so you out, I'm in. I mean, that's nonsense. So you're right. Politically, it doesn't matter. It's interesting, but politically, it wouldn't matter how that ends up.
Yeah, it always seemed like such a kind of hollow point. And, I don't know. It's funny the difference between the reality and the narrative, or the reality and, the way it's perceived by people in general in the United States. I mean, it's kind of a matter of cognitive dissonance, right? It's on one hand, a bunch of Russians and Poles and God knows who from Europe, German Jews who came as refugees after World War II, and they settled this land. And they haven't made a very smooth transition, dude, by all accounts, right? So on one hand, that means that this really isn't working without these massive doses of violence all the time. And so, geez, maybe there's something else could happen. But at the same time, on the other hand, hey, they're whiter, so let them do whatever the hell they want, because who cares about a bunch of sand and words anyway, right? And so that's the American... Well, and of course, there's all the right-wing born-again Christians who are trying to force Jesus to come back sooner and all this crap, too. But the basic bottom line of it is that, you know, even it was one last gasp for white colonialism in the browner parts of the world. And to Americans, like, you know, they basically identify with it. You know, it's a settler colony, the Palestinians or the Indians. What do you got to do? If you're going to have your country, you got to get rid of your Indians, don't you? Kind of thing. Isn't that the way?
Yeah, I mean, it's good you mentioned the word, colonialism or imperialism, because I have to remember that the Israel is the, as I put it on Facebook recently, Israel is the child, the offspring of nationalism and imperialism, which seem to be at odds, right? Because national groups will revolt against imperialists who want to rule. But that's what happened. It's Jewish nationalism arises, Zionism, in other words, arises in the age of nationalism in the 19th century when Italy is unifying, you know, Germany is unifying. So Herzl says, hey, we're a nation too. On the other hand, as we know from our reading about World War One, and everybody ought to read about this because if you want to come to really hate the state, read about World War One in detail. France and England wanted to make sure that they were going to be ruling the Middle East, and so they made promises they knew they would never be able to keep or fully keep. They certainly couldn't keep all of them. So they told the Arabs, revolt against the Turks, because the Turks were aligned with Germany and the Central Powers in World War One. You revolt and you'll get your independence, which you've long wanted. You don't want to be under the thumb of the Turks. And the Arabs were pretty sure they couldn't trust the British, but they said, what the hell? It's better than staying under the Ottomans. Let's take a chance. So they agreed. Meanwhile, the British want to win over Jewish support, particularly American Jewish support, for their effort in World War One. Don't forget, most American Jews were German. Their sympathies originally in that war were with Germany. Don't forget, it wasn't the Nazis. It was the Kaiser. There was anti-Semitism in Germany, but it wasn't the Nazis. So their first sympathy was with the land their parents had come from, Germany. So the British put on this campaign to win over they thought the American Jews were extremely powerful. They weren't, but they thought if we can win over the Jews in America for the war effort, Wilson will get in the war, right? This is before Wilson gets in the war. So they issue the Balfour Declaration, which says we'll allow you to have a national home. They used a national homeland or national home. They used this euphemism. The Jews meant state, and the Zionists meant state. But when I say the Jews, I'm really got to be careful, because most Jews despised Zionism. The Orthodox hated Zionism and the Reform hated Zionism. They said, go away. Get away from us. When they went to the Reform, when a Zionist went to an Orthodox Jew, he'd say, let me start it this way. When they went to Reform, American Reform, the Americans would say, we have a homeland. It's called the United States. They said, America's our Zion. Get out of here. If they went to an Orthodox, the Orthodox would say, who died and made you the Messiah? In other words, the Jews weren't going back to the Holy Land until the Messiah came, not Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion was an atheist. Herzl was a assimilated secularist. They mocked the Eastern Jews. They mocked the Orthodox Jews. They thought the Orthodox Jews were superstitious and dirty, and they hardly wanted them in Israel. I mean, they realized they had to have them, but they didn't like them. So Zionism was a very small sect in those days before World War I. And yet they somehow the British thought if we issue the Balfour Declaration, this is going to win the Jews over to World War One. Of course, Wilson didn't need Jewish support to get into World War One, and he did it anyway. But my point is, Israel's the result of imperialism, British and French imperialism, and nationalism. This idea that the Jews somehow constituted a nation. Talk about having two ill-founded parents, a nationalist and an imperialist. It had to go bad.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know. I've always kind of been of the opinion, although, you know, Not that it's really my business, but it's interesting. It seems like, well, you know what? And maybe you and I have talked about this once upon a time. MJ Rosenberg wrote this great article way back when, which is lost to history because it was on the Media Matters website of all places, and they deleted it. But it was this great history that he did about how ever since the creation of Israel anyway, if you take 48 for a given and all that, that through at every major turning point of violent conflict with the Palestinians and with the neighbors and what have you, that there were powerful and influential Israelis who knew better, who were in the government at the height of their power, who said, wait, no, don't do this, guys. And then they did it anyway. And then he just cites over and over and over, example after example after example, about the Israelis in the, his frame just digging themselves a deeper and deeper pit here, with the counter-narrative being that, man, not that it would have been utopia, but that if they had had the attitude all along that, okay, yeah, we stole 78% of Palestine and everything, but now let's try and make peace. Now let's try and have constructive relationships with the neighbors and with the Palestinians, and let them have their independence and get along. That actually, that was a perfectly possible route to take. You know, they weren't forced into all these situations. They take advantage and start wars. So, you know, as we've seen in 67, we just talked about with Ray McGovern on the show a minute ago here before you. And this kind of thing. So the counterfactual, it seems, you know, not perfect, but there seems to be a narrative there where the Israelis, if they had just taken their fait accompli of 48 and they got away with that and then tried to play it cool since then as the new guy in the neighborhood who's, after all, planning on staying around for a long time, that they could be all right. But instead, this whole time, they've said no, like you said. They refuse to even define their borders. One day, all your cities will belong to us, you know?
That was the program. I mean, to say, if only they had just realized, okay, we got this, let's just settle into a normal state, then that would have meant the whole program was for naught. I mean, nobody, people don't act like that. That was never the plan. So there's no way that was going to happen.
But then this is a really shitty plan too, right? The permanent occupations and the refugees in camps all over the place and all this. This controversy constantly.
I'm sure they didn't want a permanent occupation. They wanted to quote, transfer, right, the non-Jewish communities, as they're called in the Balfour Declaration, out of the place to somewhere else, to Jordan, to somewhere else, you know. So they didn't want, look, I'll give them credit on this. They didn't want to be permanent occupiers. They didn't want anybody to occupy. That's supposed to all just become, quote, Jewish land. I think I got to mention one other thing, and then there's this, you know, this point from the article from last week we got to talk about, which is the 1924 American immigration law. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I want to mention about the Balfour Declaration, there was one opponent in the cabinet against the Balfour Declaration. He was the Secretary of State for India. He was the only Jew in the cabinet, right? Edwin Montague, very distinguished family. He denounced the Balfour Declaration as anti-Semitic. He said, all you people who want to pack the Jews up and send them off to Israel or Palestine, you're anti-Semites. Of course you want to pack the bags and say, hey, let me help you. Let me help you with your bags there. You want to kick them out. You want to get them out of Britain. He was the only one that prominent who saw what the heck was going on. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the American reform reacted to it. But the other key thing, and you know, I first was alerted to this by Shlomo Sand. He says the Balfour Declaration is not what really started Israel. What started Israel was a bill signed by Calvin Coolidge, passed overwhelmingly by the Congress in 1924, and then also a similar bill passed by the British Parliament in 1905, which put very strict quotas on people, in the American case, on people from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. So it was directed at Jews and Catholics. Everybody knew that at the time. Okay, it was a racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic law. Overwhelmingly passed in the Congress. It's called the Johnson-Reed Act. And signed by Calvin Coolidge. As an aside, Calvin Coolidge, for some weird reason, is a president that some libertarians like, or at least think, you know, he's the least bad president. because he was pro-business. That's usually the way it works. But he signs this law saying we must, keep America American. That's your great Calvin Coolidge signing the bill. This law put very strict quotas on. This is 1924. It meant that you could only, I think every year, you could have only 2% from these countries, 2% of the census from 1890, right? In 1924, they're saying, look at the 1890 census, and then you can see how many, additional people can come in. It's a trickle. You may remember the stories of 1939 when the German ship St. Louis almost got to Miami with almost 1,000 Jews trying to escape Hitler, 1939, post-Kristallnacht and all that. The Roosevelt administration turns away the ship. They can see the faces of the people on the port waiting for them to land. They see the lights. And Roosevelt says no. Why? Authority of this 1924 law. The point is, if that 1924 law had not been passed and we had generally open immigration like Ellis Island, like we had in the 19th century or even better, there wouldn't have been an Israel because the Jews would have come here or to England.
You mentioned that ship, those particular Jews, many of them were killed in Auschwitz.
They were sent back to Germany. Roosevelt, the great hero. But it's not just him. We shouldn't just blame him. The point is, Sand's point is that there would not have been Israel without that. There also might not have been a Holocaust or very, very scaled down Holocaust, because most of the Jews would have gotten out. In 1924, if you don't have these quotas, and if England hasn't passed its thing in 1905, Jews, they didn't want to go to Palestine. They wanted to go to the West. They loved America. They liked America. They had the shining, vision. Or they would have gone to England or Canada. If they could have gotten in, there would have been hardly any Jews from the West to channel to Israel. The shame of the Zionist movement is they wanted all the safety valves shut off except the one to Palestine. They wanted only one place to go, and that's the Palestine. And so they weren't agitating for opening up. I doubt if they opposed this bill, and in the 30s and 40s they weren't putting pressure on Roosevelt to let Jews in, even on an emergency basis. Oh, they said things like, "Oh, we don't want to incite anti-Semitism." That may have been part of the reason, but a big part of the story is they wanted the Jews to have only one place to go because they were looking ahead to the establishment of Israel as the Jewish state, and it's not a very pretty story in the history of Zionism in a pretty sordid history altogether. That's one of the worst aspects of it.
Yeah. So, I read recently again, I had always forgotten who said this first, but it was the king of Saudi Arabia when he met with Franklin Roosevelt. He said, don't give them Palestine, right. Give them the best part of Germany. Well, that sounds reasonable. I mean, if anybody's ever been collectively guilty of anything and need their property rights violated, screw them, Let them go live under Soviet communism and let the Jews have the western half of Germany. Right. That would at least be fair. And they're Europeans, after all, so that makes more sense. And the Palestinians didn't do a damn thing to them. The point was, though, that the Palestinians, in the words of Lord Grey and all the rest of them, were just N-words, and their lives don't matter to know how anyway.
No, they were never consulted on any of this, Balfour or anything else. You're right, it was a reasonable response by the king, Ibn Saud. However, even that wasn't right, because I have a feeling most of the German Jews and the other European Jews wouldn't have wanted to stay there. Their horrible memories, and even though that was their homes, they would have come to America. That's the thing. Or perhaps England or some other, other places. But America was going to be the big magnet. So they should have been allowed in. And I don't mean just Jews. I mean, we should have open immigration. But if you do that, to repeat this point, you don't get Israel because there's no people pouring into Israel, into Palestine. And you don't, of course, again, we're going back to 24. So we're talking about pre-Nazis. You don't get a Holocaust. I mean, there aren't going to be that many people around to do it. And don't forget, initially the Germans are interested in driving the Jews out, not just wholesale killing them. So at least the German Jews. So think of how different the world would have been had Coolidge not signed that and had Americans been welcomed immigrants with open arms, as they did to a very large extent. And we all remember the stories of Ellis Island. Almost anybody could get in. If you had a communicable disease, they quarantined you for, a couple of weeks, and then they sent you into New York. If we had only done that and kept doing that through the 20s, the world would be so different. Because think of what happens if you don't have all this tension in the Middle East. Now, the imperial powers still would be interested in oil. That's certainly true. But you wouldn't get this. You don't even get 9/11 because of this, you know, because you don't have Israel attacking Lebanon and influencing Attah to make out his will and fly into a building in New York. I mean, the whole world changes. I'm not saying everything is then perfect and, you know, sweetness and light, but a huge source of tension is removed.
Yeah.
Because Jews are living happily where they'd rather be, America or England.
Yeah. All right. Well, word to the people of the Gaza Strip out there doing their massive civil disobedience demonstration there, marching on that fence. It's not a border. I saw a Twitter friend said that that's the one silver lining of this whole current protest going on, is that the Israelis have had to admit that they have a border, which has never happened before. They keep calling this a border fence in order to make their actions sound defensive, but they're accidentally conceding far too much of the truth of at least how it's supposed to be there. So interesting point, at least. Maybe we should leave it there, Sheldon, we think.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that this went over long. I hope the people liked it. You've written some really fascinating stuff here in this recent series. And you know, before that, of course, it's all at libertarianinstitute.org. We're running it all at antiwar.com as well, of course. And it does get reprinted, some of this stuff, from place to place. The Great Sheldon Richmond. So here's a few of the most recent ones. How an anti-Semitic American law created the state of Israel and a whole lot of trouble. The Abused Jews of Iraq. Before that, Shabbos with Zaidi, which we talked about before in the most recent interview. And then the brand new one today, TGIF, separation, not association, requires force. Thanks again, Sheldon. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Talk to you next week.
All right, you guys, that's the Scott and Sheldon Show. We're going to do this every Friday now. How do you like that? Pretty good, huh? All right, so you guys know the deal. FoolsErrand.us for the book, ScottHorton.org, and YouTube.com/ScottHortonShow for all the interviews. 4,500 of them now, going back to 2003 for you there. Read what I want you to read at antiwar.com and at libertarianinstitute.org, and follow me on Twitter at ScottHortonShow. Thanks.